Blog Talk Radio.
Never been filled since the dews began. Jacala's mouth and the glut of the kite and the hands of the ape and the eyes of man. Greetings, 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 and welcome to another episode of Zariana Radio. This is your host and humble storyteller, Evan Poss. And I'm here in the studio, Cafe Fairfax. Daniel Michael is joining us in a minute. I think he's setting stuff up on the other computer and getting the chat room all set up. So look forward to you folks joining us today. And I've got a really good selection of stories here. We're going back to a classic theme on this show, that of traditional Hindu folk tales, obviously a favorite of mine. All right, here he is, the man himself, Daniel Mike. How you doing?
And it looks like we're back. That was very strange.
Technical glitch there.
Hello? And hello. Okay. It's we're fine. We had a brief microphone problem, but we're back.
All right. So, how you doing today, Daniel?
Doing just fine. Yesterday we had a show discussing the history of the devil, and we covered all sorts of things, everything back from Zoroaster to leading to duality itself, to Alexander then conquering the Iranians, Persians, the idea of Hades beginning to form the idea of the punishment place, even though Hades wasn't necessarily a punishment, but
no, Hades wasn't a punishment at all, because all dead souls,
I just went there.
Go to Hades.
However, the god of Hades could just sort of decide whether it was a little more pleasant for you or not. But Then it was we went to Gehenna, which was the actual physical real place where they used to burn their rubbish heaps. And as a dishonorable death, if you were a criminal of some sort, you could get thrown into the rubbish heap. The Gehenna was a very real place and was the inspiration for hell.
Interesting.
The burning after you die.
Now, where is this?
This is, of course, a different place. We're talking about Iran at first, then
right.
Israel, Jerusalem. And there was a couple other places that were punishment places, like labor places, that were also inspirations for hell. I think one was some sort of underground mine. And then we just went on into the images of the devil.
Well,
how it evolved.
Before we move on, you mentioned Hades, and I think there's a really interesting quote. You know, I can't remember verbatim, but it's from the Iliad. And I think, I don't remember what part it comes from, but of course the great hero of the Iliad is Achilles. And one of the main themes in the Iliad, as opposed to the Odyssey, you know, a very different theme and a very different ideal here, is that of the honor of dying on a battlefield as a warrior, going out in a reign of glory, you know, and being remembered eternally. Earlier in his life, Achilles, I think, is promised by one of the gods he can either live out a long and happy life and, you know, to be forgotten afterwards, you know, a long life of fulfillment, and no one will remember him. Or he could go out, you know, short and sweet with a boom, make his mark on the world, and die young. And I think it's something to the Greek ideal, especially at this time. This is quite early on in Greek history, before the Classical Age, that Achilles chooses to go out a hero, to die young as the greatest warrior who ever lived and whoever fought upon the battlefield. Now, the interesting thing happens when, who is it? It's going to bother me now, but one of the Greek heroes who goes into Hades, into the afterworld, to find, like, a relative or a lover or something like that. I can't remember now. But he encounters Achilles in Hades. One moment.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Oh, I see. All right, we got a couple callers. We're gonna hold off on that for a moment, unless you're
afraid.
Calling to talk about the Odyssey or Hindu.
We have taken off of the marquee readings. I took it off this morning. We do not have our cards with us.
Yes, I think you guys, if you listened to my last episode, might have gathered an inkling of how I've been feeling about that recently.
But if you're calling to listen, that's fine, or to discuss any of the myths Evan is discussing, but I've taken free readings off the marquee. That doesn't mean for every Main Street Universe show. We still do readings on some of our other shows.
Right. Now, one of our callers is left, so that leaves one other, but so let's finish this thought here. So this other Greek hero encounters Achilles after he has died on the battlefield, of course. I think it's Paris, the young Trojan prince, who shoots an arrow that strikes him in his one weak spot, his Achilles tendon, where his mother dipped him into the river of immortality, holding him by the ankle. And so the water touched his whole body, except for that one part. And because of that, he was not completely invincible. And, you know, Paris took advantage of that, and a great hero was slain. Now, what does Achilles tell us about the afterworld, about Hades? Because we know that, you know, as Dan mentioned, it's not like a hell realm necessarily, because all the dead go there. You know, it's not just for the wicked or, you know, anything like that. There's no judgment involved like in the Egyptian afterlife where, you know, you go to this, you know, hell-like realm if your heart is heavier than the feather on the scale. All the dead in the Greek world go to the same afterlife. Of course, there's different, you know, different places within it, but which we're given to understand, none of it's really all that pleasant. It's better to be alive than it is to be dead. And this is exactly what Achilles says to this Greek hero. He says, is it Hercules? It might have been Hercules. Anyway.
I forget.
He says, it's better, something to the effect of, it's better to live a long, dull life behind the plow than it is to be here. Basically, he regrets his choice. You know, he would have, looking back on it in hindsight, he would have given up all that glory, not be remembered. And
I don't believe him. I believe, as we've said before, we're here to entertain the gods. Just as we are creations and creators, and human beings obviously like to be entertained, even though much of that entertainment is horrible.
Well, it could be much more of an indication that human beings cannot help or regret the decisions we make, whatever they are.
Of course.
So, you know,
hindsight's always 20/20 and all that kind of thing.
Like, he probably would have regretted not being a warrior had he lived out his long, dull life behind the plow.
Like what I'm doing now.
Maybe.
Except for it's not a plow.
It's the 21st century equivalent thereof.
We were there till like past 1 in the morning last night.
Ooh, I was off last night. Okay, well, we still got this caller, so
okay.
Dan, would you like to do the honors?
Sure. Now, I am letting you know we do not have our cards with us. So I have taken it off of your marquee that you do reading. I was a little bit surprised when I saw some callers lined up for that.
Well,
that's okay.
We might not have advice to offer.
Sure. Miss A has checked into the chat room. Hello, Miss A. And you know what? This number actually looks maybe familiar to me. So,
area code?
267. You're on the air?
Hello? Hey, how you doing today?
Doing well, doing well. And how are you?
I have a question. As far as this goes is concerned, can you give me a basic general reading? Like general reading? Relationship, school, future, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if you were just listening to, you know, the last 5 minutes or so. We're not really doing this reading business anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a question, maybe we can give advice, but we're not.
We don't have our cards with us.
Show, and me personally, I'm not going to put on a pretense of offering, you know, mystical, spiritual advice, you know, from some arcane divination system, you know, just for sheer entertainment value. I mean, if it's a real question, sure, we'd be happy to help, but you know,
we do not have. He said a general thing, but we don't have our cards with us. And for Zariana Radio, we're no longer advertising.
My general advice would be to stay in school, to follow your dreams, to follow your bliss, to weigh all the options that you have, think about them, meditate on them, you know, and figure out what you really want out of life. Figure out what's going to make you happy in the end. Because, you know, nothing else is going to be able to give you any indication of that. You need to know and need to search your soul for what is going to bring you true happiness and, you know, what you want to bring forward to the world. It's like we're all actors upon this stage, and we all offer very, you know, very different things. That's why we play different roles, to keep up the variety, you know, to keep up the mix, to make this a good entertainment for the gods who are watching us in every moment. So, you know, really the greatest honor that we have and the most honorable role that we can play is to be ourselves at the deepest level, to find out what it is that makes us tick, what it is that makes us blossom, that makes us smile, that makes us shine.
You know?
Every one of us, it's our responsibility to shine in this world. But not just anything's going to bring that out of us. You know? Dan and I are working in retail right now, and we can tell you from firsthand experience, we work in a grocery store. We do this show, and we may have, some pretense of, having some wisdom, and we certainly do. And, we put on these eclectic shows, and we read these wonderful stories, and, get these amazing people to come on, and this is what we do. But at the same time, if working that retail job isn't bringing it out of you, then, there's always a path to what you're looking for. You can always get there from here. That's a mantra.
Thanks,
you can get
man.
There from here. So from whatever it is, just, think in your mind, like, envision it. What am I going for in life?
And you're going somewhere soon, right?
That I am, and maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. What am I going for? And then this plan around that. Maybe you want to be an artist. Maybe you like to draw or to paint, or a musician, or a certain instrument. Or you like to write, or you like to sing, or dance. Or maybe it doesn't have to do necessarily being an artist at all, or some other occupation. Maybe there's a field of study that you're particularly interested in. If it has to do with relationships, maybe there's a certain person that you, have never had the courage to say something to. Maybe that's not the case at all, but, maybe your life has a spiritual calling. And, time in an ashram or a monastery, might be what you're looking
all
for.
Right.
But whatever it is, as the great Joseph Campbell, one of my own mentors and a great inspiration in my life, says, follow your bliss. Follow your bliss and you can't go wrong. No divination system's going to tell you it's any better than we can, just tell ourselves right here, right now with this. And, that's the gist of it. That's it. Follow your bliss and you'll find it.
Thank you, caller. And it looks like we lost him. Okay. Follow your bliss, as Evan said. But on our other shows, we do still do reading. It's just we've sort of, for the most part, taking it out of this one. We had a few people in the chat room that have come and gone. And let's go ahead and get on with the show here, Evan.
The first piece I actually read in the beginning, the jungle saying, of course, dead giveaway right there, is one of my own favorites, Rudyard Kipling. Great British writer living in India. I love how he writes from the perspective of the jungle. No one can do it better than he can. These are the four that are never content, that have never been filled since the dews began. Jacala's mouth and the glut of the kite and the hands of the ape and the eyes of man. The eyes of man, never content, never filled. It's true, isn't it? I mean, I suppose there's every piece I read on here, there's a reason for it. If it doesn't strike me a certain way, if it doesn't move me, I'm not going to, come on this radio show and read it to you. If it doesn't ring bells in me, I don't, it may ring bells for other people, of course, but I'm not going to assume that. I want to read the stuff that moves me personally. And that last line, that resonates. Now, why is it that the eyes of man are never content? Or what does that mean in our own lives? You know, always want to see new places. I actually just got back several days ago from Portugal. We also went across the Minho River in the north into Spain for a little bit. It was a wonderful trip. Went with my family. My family is actually Portuguese. We're from northern Portugal there, and every several years we, you know, make a trip out there. When you know, everything's aligned and we can all make it happen at the same time, and this was one of those times, and it was an amazing trip. I got to spend time with my little brother, visited some amazing places, went back to Lisbon, of course, is Lisboa, one of my favorite cities, magical place. Porto on the river is just, you know, sublime, the cityscape there. It's something out of the old world, you know. It's come to the future, you know, in a very, you know, fashionable way. But it's still like you feel like you're living in a city of, you know, 300, 400, 500 years ago. Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain across the Minho River is actually the final resting place of the Apostle James. Visit his grave is inside of the cathedral, and you walk through it, and you see it for yourself, the final resting place of the Apostle James. It's a place of miracles and of magic. We visited there when I was probably 12 or 13. And, you know, I remember being just as moved then, but this time around, I think just having more of an appreciation for it and a receptivity. You know, it's really hard to visit a place like that without, you know, almost just like breaking you down, like, you know, to your spiritual essence. Like, what is there to say afterwards? Like, how can you speak about something like that? This, the energy in the place is unreal. And, you know, with any level of receptivity, it will certainly move you. And it is a place of healing and a place of miracles. The symbol of that city, Santiago de Compostela, and the cathedral is actually the clamshell. I find fascinating. You know, there's a big emphasis there on the Virgin Mary and, like, you know, the feminine aspect of God, which so often gets overshadowed. It's profane to say, but, like, you can't ignore it. The food there in, you know, I mean, all over, of course, but in Santiago de Compostela, the food is just, like, some of the most amazing things I've ever eaten. So, you know, even if you're just into, you know, eating some good tapas, that is certainly a place to go. And don't forget to check out the cathedral while you're there. In Coimbra, we visited one of the oldest universities in Europe, founded in the year 1290. Poked my head inside a library that was pretty much gilded in gold, you know, from top to bottom. Just like innumerable gold-threaded books dating back to the Middle Ages. You know, on topics that, you know, I'm sure I'll never have the joy of you know, reading for myself, but it's an honor just to have that sight, you know. It was incredible. So, and as Dan mentioned, I am going somewhere soon. Last night I was up quite late. Really didn't get much sleep last night. I've been doing a lot of research. I've been looking at plane tickets. I've been looking at backpacks. I've been looking looking at visa information, everything you can imagine. Thanks. Right, well, maybe it's that in a minute. I like it too. Dan's referring to a coat that I picked up when I was in Lisbon from a little Nepali import shop. Beautiful guy who ran the place, Deepak. And some killer deals on these Nepali threads. This jacket I got here, I love it. Really good for cold weather. They had a lot of cool clothes in there. The clothes from Nepal are too cool. You see a lot of this style, like especially in California, Northern California. Like, you know, a lot of people up there are rocking, you know, the Nepali clothes. They're really expensive. Like, this would be like three times as much as I paid for it in Lisbon. You know, the economy in Portugal really isn't all that hot, so, you know, you get some good deals sometimes. So I am planning excursion right now, and, you know, keep you updated on that. So we might be seeing the last few shows for Zariana Radio for, you know, at least the immediate future. Although in all likelihood, I'll probably will be back in this area. I'm also looking at graduate school, a master's degree in folklore. I'm actually from George Mason, which is just down the street from where we are here in Cafe Fairfax. So, I should be back in the area, and, you know, this show might have to take a hiatus at some point, although we've still got a couple good shows left in us. And, you know, I'm sure I'll be corresponding with Dan and, you know, contributing when I can to the network. You know, possibly if I, you know, get a chance calling in and, you know, maybe dropping in on some of the shows here and there. I have to get a phone out there, of course. But I am referring to India. I've been looking at flights to Cochin in the beginning of the year. So maybe that's why I'm reading Indian folktales right now, because I'm just way too excited and I can hardly contain myself. We'll see how I get through these last few weeks of work. It doesn't seem possible right now, but I'm just gonna have to suck it up and do it. It's gonna be worth it in the long run. I've got my vision, you know. Need that fat Christmas bonus, yo. need every rupee I can get. Yes, yes, yes. All right. So I've got one story here that I'm definitely gonna read. I wanna maybe find a different one first. I'm actually flipping through my folk tales from India, the collection by A.K. Ramajan, the Pantheon Fairy Tale and Folklore Library. I've read out of this several times on the show, and something I could always go back to. I've read every one of these stories at least a couple times, and, you know, they're just brilliant. I love every one of them. You know, let's skip straight to what I got in mind here. Straight to the meat. All right. You guys, this is a real treat I have for you here. It doesn't get any better than this. Hindu folklore first class. It's called The Adventures of a Disobedient Son. King had four wives and four sons, one son by each wife. He had no care in the world, enjoyed every luxury and pleasure. He had many long titles. 24 other kings paid him tribute, and his kingdom was truly vast. One day, he sat on the swing under the full moon, playing love games with his queens. That sounds nice, doesn't it? Kid can dream. He was struck by a fancy. He summoned his four sons to his presence and asked the eldest of them, "Son, you are my eldest, the future king in this country. What are your plans?" The son obediently answered, "Oh, father, I'll follow in your illustrious footsteps. I'll try to become a great king, just like you." He asked the second son the same question, "Son, what are your plans?" "Oh, father, I'll be a statesman and help my brother rule the kingdom." When the third one was asked, he answered, "I'll be a great commander and help my brothers rule in peace." When the fourth son's turn came, he answered differently, "Oh, father, you are the king of kings. 24 kings pay you tribute. I want to do better than you. I'll conquer kingdoms, marry four celestial wives, and build my own city." "What?" the king exploded. "Do better than me? You beast on two feet. You'll marry celestial wives and do better than me?" In his rage, he called his servants and shouted, "Throw him out! Banish him to the jungle at once! Little beast!" His mother tried to pacify the old man, but he would not listen to her. So she went in and prepared a bundle of rice for her banished son, and tearfully bade him goodbye. The youngest son promptly left the palace, went out of the city, and walked straight on till he found himself in a forest, where he heard nothing but the roar of tigers and lions on one side, and the trumpeting of wild elephants, grunting of wild pigs on the other. He cautiously climbed a tall tree and spent the night among its branches. At dawn, in the light of day, he came down, bathed in a nearby lake, and prayed to the bull, the vehicle of Shiva and his family god, to protect him. As he was walking away, his eyes fell on a cobra, its hood poised to fall upon a frog and gobble it up. He chased away the cobra with a stick and saved the frog's life. To his surprise, the frog spoke to him in gratitude and said, "Think of me if you are ever in need," and plunked into the water. The young prince then ate from a bundle of rice his mother had given him, and walked on again through the wilderness till night fell. When it was dark, he saw a small lamp flickering in the distance, and he made for it like a bee to a flower. Soon, he was standing at the door of a hut when he called, "Anybody home?" A very old woman came out and took him in. She said, "You must be tired. Wash your feet and rest here tonight." When she asked him why he was in the jungle, he briefly told her his story and asked her in turn how she happened to live alone in this forest. She said, "My name is Sickle, Granny. My story is a long one.
rest now. I'll tell you some other time.
But the young prince was curious and insisted on hearing the story right away. So she told him her story.
I may not look it, but I'm the daughter of a great sage. Though he was a sage famous for his austere way of life, one day he went mad with lust and bothered my mother to no end. She didn't want to give in to his lust, for that would have canceled all his past history as a sage. She tried to save him from himself, but he wouldn't listen. He took her by force, had his way with her, and satisfied himself. So I was born ugly as sin. Soon after I was born, he went into the same jungle you just came through. And while he was gathering fruit, a tiger attacked him and tore him limb from limb. My mother died soon after, and I was orphaned. Because I knew I was very ugly, I stayed on in the forest and never went into town. I just prayed and worshipped every day. And I attained the powers one gets only by such penance. Many marvels I have seen then. I could tell you more, but it can wait. It's late, and you must sleep. The prince stayed with her and helped graze her cows. The old woman had only one rule for him. When you take the cows out to pasture, never go towards the north.
He had said, "Yes, I'll remember that." But one day, his natural curiosity made him want to see what was in the north that he shouldn't see. So he drove the herd in that direction. He came upon wonderful sights. He was particularly taken with a beautiful bathing tank built with gold bricks and with steps set in the finest crystal. Green, red, pink, blue, and yellow fish sported in the water. He had hardly sat down under the shade of the jambu tree that spread its branches over one side of it when four celestial women appeared as if from the sky. He hid himself behind the tree and watched them take off their yellow silk Pitambara saris, jump noiselessly into the well, and splash each other with the crystalline water, having quite a great time. On an impulse, the prince picked up one of the saris and fled. The sari belonged to none other than Indra's own daughter. She saw him run off with her sari, so she quickly got out of the water and ran after him, crying out, "Oh, young man, you look like a hero. I'll marry you and no one else. Stop, turn around and look at me." Astonished, he stopped, and the celestial woman at once snatched her sari from his hand, changed him into a cold stone, and vanished. When the prince did not return home as usual by evening, the old woman became anxious. Wand and lantern in hand, she set out in search of him in the south, the east, and the west, but she found no trace of him there. She guessed that he must have gone to the forbidden north. When she went in search of him there, she found him lying on the ground, a piece of rock. She struck it with her wand, and he returned to life and scooped up his own body. They hurried home to safety, and she scolded him. "Didn't I tell you never to go north? I meant never." "Yes, Granny, you did tell me. But I knew somehow that's where my life would be fulfilled. So I couldn't resist it. I went. In fact, I want to go there again."
All right. Go if you must. But take some precautions. Don't take the cows with you. And don't be beguiled by those celestial wenches, their looks and sweet words. This time, when you pick up the sari, run straight home. I'll be waiting for you, and I'll take care of the rest."
He followed her instructions. The next day, he ate his morning meal early and went back to the place of the beautiful tank and hid himself under the jambu tree. Today, too, the women arrived and unwrapped their saris before his unbelieving eyes. He gazed on them, his eyes moving from head to toe. What shapes! What complexions! Coral streaked eyes. Faces like the moon. Cascades of black hair flowing down to their buttocks. Round breasts. Like perfect melons. And all of them young, virginal. They dived into the water, leaving their saris and pearls on the dry ground. The prince leaped from his hiding place, quickly snatched the same sari he had taken the previous day, and ran. Its celestial owner ran out of the water and followed him, weeping and calling to him. But he was not deceived. He ran straight to the hut and handed the heavenly sari to the old woman, who changed him at once into a small baby and put him in a cradle. She pretended to rock him and to lull him to sleep with lullabies. With her magic, she also placed the sari inside the baby's thigh and sewn it up without a seam showing. A few moments later, the celestial woman arrived at her door, panting, and asked her, "Did anyone come this way? A young man?"
"A young man? No. No one has come this way. I've been here for hours,"
said the old woman. He may be hiding here somewhere."
"Before you do anything, dearie, you must hide your shame. It's not good. It's not a good idea to go around naked. Take this piece of cotton cloth and wrap yourself up."
After a few minutes of this pretense and teasing, the old woman said to her,
"I know where your sari is.
can have it back if you agree to marry him. The celestial woman agreed. The old woman changed the prince back to his original form. And they were married right there, in that hut, with the old woman as the wedding priest. They lived there for a few days. One day, he took leave of the old woman and moved on. He had yet to win 3 more wives for himself, hadn't he? Yes, 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 yes. The prince and his celestial bride talked to each other endlessly on their journey and soon found themselves at the gate of a city. The townspeople were struck by their beauty. They thought he was like the Lord Krishna, and she like his consort Rukmini, the very dwelling place of all that is lovely. A boy in the street who was eating a piece of sugar candy was so entranced watching them that he began to bite into his own fist. A woodcutter missed his stroke and axed his own leg. People forgot themselves, looking at these splendid newcomers. The prince rented a small house and found a job with the local king. A few days later, when the prince and his wife were sitting on a swing, gently swaying, 2 of the king's servants came to give him his month's pay. They were so dumbstruck by his wife's beauty that they ran back to the king. And as soon as they found their words, stammered, "Your Highness, Your Highness, we've found you a most fitting prize in that new man's house. It's his wife. She looks so fantastic. She doesn't seem to be a mortal woman at all." The king lost his reason and fell into a fantasy. The more vividly they described her, the more did he want her all for himself. When the young man went to court the next day as usual, he found the king absent. He inquired where he was and was told that the king was sick with a pain in his stomach. So he hurried to the king's quarters in the palace and greeted him. "Victory to the king!" But the king's voice was feeble. "I'm glad to see you. You're like a long-lost brother. I'm dying of a stomach ulcer. Oh, the only cure, my doctors tell me, is the poison of the snake Karakutaka. Can you get it for me?" Prince did not see through the old man's guile. He volunteered and promised to get it for him if it would save the king's life. He came home thinking how he should go about getting the poison of Karakutaka, the most deadly of serpents. He sat down, lost in thought, forgetting even to eat. His wife roused him from his deep reverie by asking what was troubling him. He told her about the king's illness and the remedy. She had a way. "Go to the north, beyond the Jambu Peak, and you'll reach Sheshadri Hills in a few miles. On one of those hills, under a tamala tree, you'll find a snake mound. I'll give you a letter. Throw it in the snake hole and wait." And she gave him a letter to take. He ate his dinner and slept happily. The next morning, he woke up and set out on his quest. On his way, he noticed a Bharani worm writhing miserably in a spider's web on the twigs of a tree. He carefully released the worm from the filament and saved its life. Then he walked on till he reached the snake mound and slipped his wife's letter into the hole. Soon, he heard noises from within. Several serpents came out to carry him magically into the netherworld, the Nagaloka, and set him before the Nagaraj, king of the snakes. He was intently reading the letter. "O snake king of the netherworld, this is a letter from Indra's daughter, who is like one of your own daughters. The bearer of this letter is my husband. As I am rather lonely in the earth world, please marry your daughter to this fine man and send her with him. The two of us will be happy together, I assure you. Please grant his request about what he will tell you, yours, etc." The Snake King liked his looks and proceeded to marry him to his daughter right away. Then he arranged for the newlywed's journey. His personal retinue went with them for safe conduct till they crossed the Jambu Peak. The prince was also given a sealed vial of Karkotaka's venom. When they reached home by evening, the two women, who were old friends, were ecstatic to see each other and gave each other many hugs. The next day, the prince took the vial of deadly venom to the king, who asked his servants to open it carefully in the palace courtyard. Even as they opened it a little, a tamarind tree in the yard began to smolder, caught fire, and became a heap of ashes. The king asked them to take the venom far away and bury it deep. So the king's first ruse did not succeed. The prince hadn't been lost or killed, and he had managed to get the deadliest venom of all. The king was now even a little afraid of the young man. Interesting. A month later, on a holiday, the king's servants brought the prince his monthly pay at home, as they had done before. This time, they saw two beautiful women instead of one, sporting with him. They hurried back to the king with their drooling descriptions. The king was beside himself with desire for the young man's fabulous wives. He sent for the prince again and said he had one of his terrible headaches, for which the cure would be crocodile's bile. Would the brave man go and get it for him? The prince came home lost in thought. Both of his wives asked him in unison, "Lord and husband of our souls, what is troubling you?" And he told them what his king wanted from him. Where could he go for a crocodile's bile? For his wives, that seemed like nothing extraordinary. They both sat down at once and wrote letters and asked him to throw them into the great ocean. He felt confident again, ate and slept well that night, and set out early the next morning in the direction his wives told him to go. On the way, he saw a young crocodile that was stranded on dry land and growing feebler by the hour. He carried it tenderly to the river, where it revived at once, finding its element. The grateful animal said, "O mortal, you saved my life. If you are ever in need, just think of me," and glided into the depths. Thank you. You reach the seashore, and as soon as he threw the letter into the waves, four crocodiles appeared and carried him safely to the presence of the king of all the seas, who, after reading the letters, eagerly offered his daughter to him with a dower of the ocean's best diamonds, and, of course, a supply of the finest crocodile bile. When the prince came home, the three unearthly beauties were happy together. Next day, when he brought the king the crocodile's bile, as he asked for, the king's heart sank. He knew his plan had failed again. The next month, when the servants brought the prince's pay, they were dazzled by the sight of three, count them, three celestial damsels laughing mischievously with him on the swing after a sumptuous meal together. They rushed back to the king, as they had done before, and told him what they had seen. Three women who were out of this world, beautiful beyond compare. The women's charms had made them eloquent. The king went almost mad with desire. So he summoned the young prince again next day and praised him. "You really are a hero. You obviously can do anything. Do you think you can go to Indra's heaven and find out how my father, mother, and brothers are doing? Only you can bring me such news." "As you wish, my king," said the prince, and went home to consult his wives. All three of them stayed up all night and wrote letters. 500 of them. He took the whole sackful, went to the king, and asked him to get ready a deep pit of fire. When the pit was filled with firewood and lit, the prince leaped into the flames. At once, the god of fire, who was waiting for him, transported him to his world, read the celestial woman's letters addressed to him and other gods, and offered him his own shining daughter in marriage. Then he sent him back to Earth. On his way back home, the prince happened to notice a stream of water running towards an anthill, and he stopped to divert the stream away from the ants. He slept well that night, surrounded by four loving women. Next morning, he took a letter to the king and another to the minister who was giving him advice. The letter to the king read as follows: "Dear son, your messenger brought us all the news about you and made us very happy. We are comfortable here without a care. We eat, drink, and dress like gods. Why don't you come and see us here? You can stay with us forever. You can come the same way your messenger came. Really, there is no other way. Come soon. We'll be waiting eagerly for your visit. Yours, etc." The king and his wicked minister were excited by these letters. They were filled with the desire to go bodily to heaven. The king ordered a great fire built before sunrise. The news spread, and the whole town was made ready to jump in. They all wanted to go to heaven and see their dead relatives. But the prince said, "Good people, be patient. Let His Royal Highness and the Honorable Minister go first. The King and the Minister, resplendently dressed, entered the fire with their entire families and entourages, and were burned to ashes before everyone's eyes. The Prince sent the townspeople home with these words. Look, the wicked king and his villainous minister are dead, as you can see. This fire won't take you to heaven. It will only burn you. Go home now and live your lives well. When he went into the king's palace, he found in the king's chamber the name of a Brahmin on a piece of paper. He at once searched for the Brahmin, found him in a little hut, and crowned him king, though the Brahmin protested. I'm a poor man, and I like it that way. What do I need a kingdom for? You rule it yourself. But the prince persuaded him. No, this is all yours. You can give me shelter when I come here next. Then he left town and went with his four wives to the forest, where, with their help, he cleared a large space, built a great new city, and lived there happily for a while. Meanwhile, his father had fallen on bad times and lost his kingdom and wealth. He had become so poor that he was cutting and selling wood for a living. The whole royal family roamed from place to place in search of pittance. One day, they arrived in the new city. The prince saw them from his balcony as they walked in the street down below. He brought them home and gave them every comfort and luxury. One day soon after, before going on a hunt with his three elder brothers, the prince gave his first wife Sari to his mother for safekeeping, with strict warnings not to let it out of her sight and not to give it to anyone. At that time, the daughters-in-law were bathing. The first wife somehow found out about the sari and asked her mother-in-law most sweetly, Mother, let me see that new yellow silk Pitambara sari. It's beautiful. Please give it to me. Let me wear it today. The mother-in-law replied, No, I can't. My son asked me not to give it to anyone. What? Not even to me? Said the first wife in a hurtful tone. Then she used her guiles, her wiles, spoke beguilingly, and won over the somewhat simple old woman. She wheeled the sari out of her before anyone could say a word. The four celestial women quickly wrapped themselves in it and flew straight to heaven. At that very moment, the great new city that was their creation also vanished. and nothing was left but the primeval jungle in its place. The old mother began to cry helplessly. The prince and his brothers, who were out hunting, seemed suddenly caught in an unknown vastness in the jungle, as if it had thickened around them before they knew it. The brothers asked him, "What's happening?" He knew. "It's all our mother's doing," he said. They slashed all about them with their swords, somehow extricated themselves from the tangle of bushes and creepers, and came to where the mother was sitting, distraught in tears. The young prince brought them all to the kingdom now ruled by the Brahmin, who was very happy to receive them. Then he went in search of his errant wives. The celestial wives had spent a while in the world of the gods, but had soon begun to miss their husband. They remembered his pranks with longing, so they decided to come down to earth. They found him wandering aimlessly. 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 And offered to take him with them to their world. "Come meet my father," said the first wife, Indra's daughter, "and you'll be able to bring all of us back with his permission. When you kidnapped me before, you didn't get his permission." "Why not? I'll come and meet your father and get his permission this time. Let's go," said the prince. And they were transported to the world of the gods by changing him into a fish in a vessel of water for the duration of their journey. Once they were in the upper world, they vanished, abandoning him in a strange place. "Women," muttered the prince to himself, and started asking around for Indra's capital. Soon, he was taken there. Everyone was amazed at the presence of a live earthling. It was not long before he was in the presence of Indra, who heard his tale and said playfully, "If you want these girls, you'll have to prove yourself worthy of them. You must perform 4 tasks that I shall set for you. If you succeed, I'll marry them all to you once more." Indra scattered a basket of tiny sesame seeds in a vast field and said, "There, pick them all up in 3 hours. And you can have the fire god's daughter back." The prince was baffled at first and thought hard. Suddenly he remembered the ants he had saved from being washed away. As soon as he thought of them, a whole swarm of them appeared, and according to his wish, picked up every sesame seed scattered in the fields and left them in a neat heap. Thus he won back one wife, his youngest. Indra then threw his singet ring into a deep well that looked bottomless and asked him to retrieve it. In a flash, the prince remembered the frog, which appeared in an instant and darted into the well at his bidding. But it returned almost at once, looking mortally afraid because there was a coil of snake guarding the bottom. It summoned its young tadpole son, took it down into the well, and threw it to the snake, which came up to eat the tadpole. Then the old frog dived in and leaped up with Indra's ring. Thus the prince won back the princess of the water world. "Now," said Indra, taking the prince to a plantain tree, "I want you to cut this tree in 3 pieces with 1 stroke. Then you'll get back the snake princess." The young prince at once thought of the crocodile he had saved on his way to the sea. The reptile appeared even as he thought of it, saluted him, and asked what he wanted done. "Do you see this plantain tree? I want it cut in 3 pieces with 1 stroke of your sharp tail." Before he had even finished saying that, 3 lay before him, and 3 neat pieces. He'd won the snake princess as well. Now Indra set his last test. With his magic, he made his daughter's 3 friends look exactly like his own daughter, and said, Tell me, who is your first wife? The prince was completely at a loss. He was faced with 4 lookalikes that he could not tell apart. So he looked at them closely. Suddenly, he remembered the Barani worm, which arrived from nowhere. Now, a winged insect. It touched the sari of Indra's daughter and flew in circles around her head. At once, the prince said, "There, that's my first wife," and seized her hand. He had won her too. The gods were amazed at the way the humble animals of the earth world had come to help this mortal man. Indra, who had hugely enjoyed the fun of it all, arranged a heavenly wedding ceremony for the young people and had them married according to celestial customs. Descended to the earth with all 4 wives and went straight to his father's kingdom, then original capital, which were now in the hands of 4 kings. He conquered them and all the minor kings around them, became king of the old kingdom, and brought back his parents and brothers to the capital. One day, under the light of the full moon, as he sat on the palace wing with his 4 queens, he remembered another such day. He asked for his father, and when he arrived, the son said to him, "Father, did I do what I once said I would do?" To which the father replied, "Yes, my son. Yes, you did. If one has sons, one should have sons like you." And so goes the adventures of a disobedient son.
Yeah, that was a very good story.
Well constructed, isn't it?
Yeah. It definitely has a good way of... It's not, it has great twists, but it's not so twisty that it completely confuses you. I mean, you kind of keep, or at least for me, I could keep the theme and the lessons. There's definitely some, you know, karma stuff going on there. And as well as perhaps even a side lesson of be careful what you desire, because others will desire it as well. You know, if you have those four celestial wives, just remember that that's an awesome thing to have, but that other people are going to want you, perhaps not to wish you, or the other people may not exactly wish you the best in order to attain what you have.
Right. It's really easy for the good people in this world to assume that everyone else is as good of intentions as they hold themselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, well, in an ideal world, yes, but, you know, in reality, you can be a little wary sometimes. Not everyone holds such high ideals.
And it makes me think of the guy walking into the bar with, like, the super, super hot girlfriend. And then, like, all the other guys, as soon as he, like, steps away for a second, then it's, you know, like, wolves on the...
Feeding frenzy?
Yeah. It's right there. And some people don't have the personality to handle that. Some people aren't the hero that our hero in this story was. He could handle it, and he thought he deserved it.
Well, this guy is really... This guy's a baller, I mean...
Yeah.
Okay, so there's one thing about this story that amazes me. Is how many of these classic tropes, you know, these classic, like, folktale story threads are within one story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't possibly get to all of them, but there's a lot. One of them is, like, the idea that when he jumps into the fire, you know, in the last part to, like, go up for his last wife to go to Indra's heaven, you know, via the fire god.
Yes.
Like, and then, like, then the king's, like, these all, like, greedy, like, oh, I want to do that too. Like, we're going to go do that. And then, like, it's, like, getting burned to ashes. Like, that happens in a lot of classic stories and folk tales. And I know I've read it in several places at least, but one of them I know for off the top of my head is Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. We have the two brothers, and the one brother, you know, like, overhears Alibaba, you know, says open sesame to get into his secret lair, and he, you know, comes back with all these riches and stuff like that. And then the other brother is all, like, greedy, like, you know, oh my god, and the first one's going to share it with him, but he's like, oh my god, I want all this gold, I want to be rich, like, I'm going to go in there with a bunch of camels and, like, steal all that gold. And he's, you know, he's so cocky about it. And he goes in and he starts, like, loading up all his camels. And then he forgets the password. They're like, open, what was it? And then Alibaba and his 40 thieves come back and see this, you know, this idiot in there, you know, with his camels all ready to go, but, you know, completely confused, has no idea what he's doing. And, of course, they, you know,
so it's like
put him up on a pike and hang him outside their, you know, outside the cave. And there's a lot of other ones, too, that like, I think also, like, with fire like that. A few of them in that book, actually.
It's the notion that someone that is ready for something going somewhere, and then someone who's not ready attempting it for whatever reason, not ready in their heart, not ready in this case. Sometimes it is because it's a person with not the best intention. So, or just in this case with Alibaba, he just got so excited he forgot a very simple password.
And it's, you know, it's always the innocent fool, you know, like the humble traveler, the unexpected one, you know, who just, like, this fate happens to cast this for him, and it was only meant for him. It wasn't meant for anyone else. And the others try to do it, and they, you know, they don't deserve it. It wasn't meant for them. And
so another lesson to be taken from that could possibly be you cannot walk another person's path, you know.
Right.
No matter how awesome it looks, you can carve out or attempt to carve out your own awesome path, but you're not supposed to be opening up their treasure chest. You're supposed to be opening up your own, you know, so that could possibly be another.
Right,
you know,
right.
We have another person's fate, destiny.
I'll try to steal someone else's magic. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm thinking about it. There's definitely a few other ones in his book. There's several renditions of that Arabian Nights, of which Ali Baba is one of them. I know there's another one of these classic storytelling threads that's in this, and like I said, there's actually a lot of them in there, is the idea that the hero is kind of out of the goodness of his own heart, you know, without even thinking twice about it, helps out all these, you know, less fortunate beings. You know, often it is animals, but it isn't always. But you get that, like, he it's out of the goodness of his own heart. He helps out the frog, the worm, the ants, and the crocodile. And he never thinks twice about it. But all of a sudden, you know, at the very end, when, like, it looks like all is lost, he suddenly remembers, like, all these friends he helped along the way, and they're there for him. And they come, and they help him. And he succeeds just because of that, you know. So if it wasn't for that pure goodness that he holds in his heart, and his natural givingness and generosity, you know, he never would have succeeded. And, you know, that's something that we see in a lot of these stories. You know, there's a lot to be gained from this. There's a lot to be learned. You know, these stories, they're not, they all have their moral, and, you know, it's like, if you can't separate the lesson from the entertainment, you know, it's kind of like one and the same. But there's a lot of good lessons to be learned here, and you know, you see this a lot. It's in many similar stories, many that even don't look that similar on the surface, but they have that same thread, you know, as I like to refer to them, because I'm not really sure how else to call it. There just are. There's like threads of stories, and you know, you can weave them all sorts of different ways and, like, combine different threads. And, like, this story has a lot of common threads that we see in other places, and that's another one. There's of course, the classic, you know, opens with the king, and he has, you know, four sons or three sons or seven sons, you know. And there's, like, a quest, and it's usually the youngest. You know, there's something about that.
I'd like to also just briefly state that for any, our signal's holding up really good today. Sometimes when I sit back at the drum kit, must be a really clear day or something. Sometimes when I'm sitting back here at the drum kit, it's so deep into the studio that it sometimes causes a lot of breakup, but it doesn't seem to be doing that today. You never know, day to day. But to the chat room folks, if there's any there, I've seen some coming and going. I am in front of the drum kit, so we're not engaging the chat room much today. And if there's been callers calling back and forth, that as well, because I'm behind the drum kit and not staring at the computer screen.
Yeah, so, I'm looking at it right now. It looks like we've had a few people come in and out, and yep.
And to the callers or anybody listening to this in the future, I have taken it off of the marquee of doing free readings on Zariana Radio.
You know, if you want to call in, I'll gladly share my advice. I don't think you guys want to hear it, but, you know, I am willing to share it because I do have some. So.
But we have other shows where people call in for readings. Kevin's show, Walking on the Sidewalk, is... his whole show is divination, just about. And also discussion. He uses the cards to kind of be external tools to even, like, look at world issues and just to discuss it, you know, kind of like using it as a tool and going, okay, let's look at this. Let's look at what happens in the world if we think of it this way, you know, that kind of a thing. So he kind of uses his oracle deck to engage in that fashion. And he's thinking of switching to being a daytime show, I think Monday morning, like an early morning show. So he's switching from his Friday night at 6, where he was with Walking on the Sidewalk, and he's switching to Monday morning. And we think it's Monday morning that he's going to switch to. And Jesse Ann Nichols George is still Friday at midnight with Activating Compassion, and she has some. Her guest this week is another nonprofit group of some sort. So she'll be talking to, I think, something to do with working with kids that have, getting help for parents that have kids that have really bad diseases and conditions. So that's what she'll be doing this midnight Friday.
Excellent. So, yeah, folks, be sure to tune in. We've got a nice variety of shows here on the Matrix Universe Network, and you know, Dan's pulling new things together and expanding it all the time. So, you know, stay posted on that.
And Wednesday, January 9th, our main show that comes on every Wednesday at 11 a.m., same time as this one does, but on Wednesday instead of Thursday, we have author Chris Penzack, which is nice. He's a nationally known, internationally known pagan author. And he wrote a book called The Inner Temple. And it's a really good, it's one of my favorite entry-level, you know, I myself, my religion, I'm pagan, but it's entry-level meditations, and, you know, the important thing is the temple within. Without really using, can always use the external tools, and I have ones of my own, but at the end of the day, it's the temple within that counts.
And on that note, we're going to wrap this show up with a very short piece, a wonderful piece, an unsuspecting piece.
It's not expecting to be read.
No, it's not. And it's not what you're expecting to hear.
Oh, okay.
So this is called, and then, Barah. A storyteller was tired of telling stories, but the children and the grown people who were all around him were not yet tired of listening to them. They asked for more. So he began to describe how a vast number of birds were sitting on a tree. People asked as usual at a pause. And then, he said, one bird flew from the tree with a sound like, Barah! And then, Barah! Went another bird flying from the tree. And then, another bird went, Barah! And then, Barah! 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 This went on until nothing was heard but, and then, and, Barah! Finally, someone asked, how long is this going to go on for? The storyteller answered, till all the birds are gone, of course.
Barah! Barah! Barah!
And until next time, you have been listening to Ariana Radio. Barah, barah, barah.